Well, if you want to, you can open up to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where Kenny just read for us. We will get there in just a moment. Tonight we're going to be talking about what Paul says to Corinthians. Beatles said, all you need is love. Paul says, what you need is love. You need it to accompany all of these other things that you're desiring, all these other things that you want. You need to do this instead of all these other problems that you have. He says, what you need is love. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is that chapter of love, and you ladies who were here on Friday night for your class, you went through 1 Corinthians 13. And you talked about love. And that's how we normally talk about 1 Corinthians 13. We look at it as this grandiose picture of what love is, about how beautiful love is. And I'm thinking about that maybe for several reasons. One, because I've been teaching 1 Corinthians at the Wendy's class. And Wednesday or Thursday night was when we taught 1 Corinthians 12 and then part of 13. Also, because I'm preaching a wedding in like 2 weeks down in Atlanta, and that's normally one of the passages that people talk about in the wedding, is this great thing of love. And thirdly, because just a few weeks ago I sat in a seminar where I also participated in this, teaching on 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, but the study was on 1 Corinthians. And something stood out to me about chapter 13 as Jeff Smeltzer presented his portion, which included chapter 13, was how you know these things about love. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, all those things. We can almost all quote it. But why is it there? Why is it right there in 1 Corinthians 13, right in the middle of a discussion about spiritual gifts? And there's reason. Because Paul has been building up his argumentation to get to chapter 13 and tell them, what you need is love. And so let's remind ourselves about the letter to the Corinthians. It's pretty simple, broke down. I'm going to give a quick overview. The first four chapters go together in that there was some division among them. There was some envying and there was some strife going on. Some were saying, I'm of Paul. Some were saying, I'm of Apollos. Some were saying, I'm of Cephas. You remember that, right? You also remember that they were talking down about Paul. There were some who were saying Paul wasn't coming, and Paul wasn't an apostle, and Paul wasn't all this stuff, and they didn't need Paul, and they didn't need Jesus, and they didn't need anybody. They were good. They had some problems. Paul addresses that in the first four chapters. And then he goes to chapters 5 and 6, where he addresses the immorality that is in the church. And so you have there in chapter 5, you have the man who has his father's wife. And how does the church feel about that? They're okay with it, aren't they? They're glorying in that. And in chapter 6, what are they doing with one another? They're taking brother to law. And they're not doing it going from brother to brother and saying, hey brother, will you be the arbitrator and the judge between us? But they were going to unbelievers in the court system between one another. Paul says, that's not the way it's supposed to be. Chapter 7, Paul gets to things that they had written to him about, and he addresses things about marriage, about whether or not they should stay married to their spouse, who is not a Christian or not, and whether or not what they should do with their, I believe, daughters who were going to be given in marriage, all those types of things. They had asked him questions, and Paul would answer those in chapter 7. And then in chapter 8, 9, and 10, he gives them a pretty scathing rebuke again because of their desire and their participation in idolatry, and specifically in the meats that were sacrificed to idols. And so you have in chapter 8 and verse 1 where he says they were claiming this knowledge, and he says knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And he goes on to talk about what they were doing. And he goes through and he goes in chapter 10 and says, hey, you remember those people back in the Old Testament that went back to idolatry, that were brought out of Egypt? Remember what happened to them? They all died. Should say, many of them died. Many of them God was not well pleased in the passage that Michael brought up this morning, 1 Corinthians 10, verses 6 and 11. But you get that, right? chapter 11, we have that difficult thing about the head covering at the beginning. And then he rebukes them because their Lord's Supper is not the Lord's Supper anymore. Their Lord's Supper has become just this feast, and they are not waiting on one another. They aren't sharing with one another. They're just eating because they're hungry, and they're drinking because they're thirsty, and they're not even thinking about the Lord who gave His body for them. And then you get to chapter 12, 13 and 14, that is in the middle here of these spiritual gifts, where they really wanted to speak in tongues. They had spiritual gifts. They had wisdom. They had faith. They had healings. They had all these different gifts, but they wanted more tongue speaking. And in the middle there, Paul says, you don't need more tongue speaking. You need love. Desire love. Chapter 13 and verse 1. 14 and verse 1. And then the last verse of chapter 12. You need love. Don't go after the tongue. And then chapter 15 with the resurrection. Some were saying that the resurrection was not going to happen. He says, hold on. If there is no resurrection and Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, then you're right, there is no resurrection. But in fact, Jesus was raised from the dead. And he has to correct them on that as well. And then chapter 16, now concerning the collection of the saints, the giving of the saints. There's your brief overview of Corinthians. Most of it is not, hey, Corinthians, you guys are doing really well. Most of it is, you Corinthians, you got some problems. You better fix them. So what does that have to do with love? Why does he say what you need is love? Well, think about the things that he says. Now is when we're here at 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7 that Kenny just read for us. I'm going to be using the ESV tonight because this is how I learned the terms. At camp, was it last summer? Last summer, this was the theme for the FC camp. And one of the guys, or a couple of the guys, they wrote a song. They put music through the words of 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7 in the ESV. So that's how I remember it, is singing the song. So that's the terms that I'm going to be using tonight for that. But I want you to think about what he says, and he points it out from this perspective. Love is, or love is not. And what you're going to find with all of these things that he lists is that the Corinthians were probably doing the opposite of what he says. So let's read these things with this idea in mind. Love is, or love is not, or does not. And then we're going to see that the Corinthians were. So think about it. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. I want you to see that love, and he begins and he ends with positives. Love is patient, love is kind, and then love rejoices in the truth, bears all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Sandwiched in the middle of that is negatives. Love does not. Love is not. Love is patient. What were the Corinthians? Look in chapter 11, what the rebuke was of them in part of the conversation about the Lord's Supper. It was not only that they were not discerning the body of Jesus, but notice what he says when he closes out in verse 33. So then, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. And if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, so that when you come together, it will not be for judgment. And at this time, I will give you directions when I come. What did they not do when they were gathered together to take this meal and they knew their brother was coming? They didn't wait. They weren't patient. They weren't bearing long-suffering, if you will, because they were hungry and they were thirsty and they didn't care about their brother, so they just said, let's go ahead, let's do it. And then secondly, love is kind. In the same context here in chapter 11, I want you to go back up to what he begins with. In verse 17, he says, in the following instructions, I do not commend you or praise you. Because when you come together, it's for the worse, right? So go down to verse 18. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you. Remember, we saw that in chapters 1 through 4. And I believe it in part. For there must be factions among you in order that you who are genuine may be recognized. It's almost like you have to make these factions and these distinctions, these divisions, so some of you are more important than the others. So notice what he says in verse 21. For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One goes hungry and another goes drunk. What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or, and here's the phrase, or do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you in this? No, I will not. What were they doing when they went ahead and one was hungry and one was drunk? Apparently, some of them had a lot. And there were some of them who didn't have. And what did they do? They did not share one another. They did not give them. They only cared about themselves. They might say, okay, well, that's a little bit. Go back to chapter 8. Forgot I didn't put that up. In chapter 8, we're gonna work backwards here. In chapter 8, it is in this section where the meat sacrificed to idols. And one has knowledge that there's one Lord and there's one God. But there were some of them who didn't have that knowledge. They didn't understand that there was only one Lord and one God. They knew it, but yet the idol was still something that was very real to them. And so they ate their meat with consciousness of the idol in verse 7. But there's this interesting thing that is said about what these people who knew there was only one Lord and there was one God, what they were doing to their brother who was still thinking about that idol. Notice what he says in verse 9. But take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. There's your warning. What you're doing could be a stumbling block to your brother. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged or emboldened? Will he not have a foundation to build his house upon if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? Your brother sees you in the temple eating it, and he's going to think, oh, I'll do that too. But yet his conscience is saying, you probably shouldn't do that, but he sees his brother doing it. So verse 11. And so by your knowledge, this weak person is hurt. Right? That's what it says. This weak person is destroyed. The brother whom Christ died for. Did they care about their brother? They cared about themselves. They were killing their brother. So verse 12, thus sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak. And the idea is you took a rod and you struck his conscience. If it was a physical thing, would it be kind if I took a stick and I just started beating you? That's not love, is it? That's not what it is. And so Paul would say, he close out in verse 13, therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat again. That's love. He's kind to his brother. He knows where his brother is at. They weren't doing that. And then back in chapter 6, what are they doing? They're going to law against one another. Now I want you to notice what is said in verses 7 and 8 about them going to law against one another. And it's almost like you guys should have handled this in-house is what he deals with first. And then he says,
Hold on. This is what you really should have done, verse 7. To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? Why not just let my brother win? Why not just suck it up and take a loss? And then he turns it on its head. Notice what they were doing, verse 8. But you yourselves wrong and defraud even your own brothers. They were taking advantage of their brothers and their sisters in Christ. Is that kind? You need love, is what you need. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy. So now we're in some of these negatives. Love does not envy. We've already talked about that. What do you think about when you think about someone being envious? They're jealous, aren't they? And isn't that what is often said here in this text? Look in chapter 3 and verse 3. Where Paul just rebukes them. He says in verse 1, I could not address you as spiritual people, but as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ. I can't even talk to you like adults. I have to talk to you like children because that's who you are. That's what you're acting like. So verse 2, I fed you with milk, not solid food, for you were not ready for it. And even now, you're not ready for it. There was a time when he was giving them what they needed, which was milk. But now they need something more solid, they need something more stable, and they can't take it. So he says in verse 3, here's why you can't take it. For you are still of the flesh. For while there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not of the flesh and behaving only in a human way? What are they thinking about? They're thinking about themselves. They are at war with one another over who's getting the most glory. And I think we would see that in chapter 12 when he's talking about the parts of the body, some that are more honorable than others. The way we look at people. And so what they're doing is they're trying to be the most important. They're trying to be the one out in the limelight. And you don't care about anybody else. You're envious of them because they are getting attention. He's saying love is not envious. But you are. Love does not envy, and love does not boast. I think most everyone says boast or maybe glories, parade itself is the idea. So it's like he doesn't walk around and we say tooting your own horn. You don't go around talking about how great you are in this display of how terrific you are. And guess what the Corinthians were doing? They were going about boasting of themselves. Go to chapter 4 there, where Paul gets kind of sarcastic with them in chapter 4, where they have received the gospel. So notice verse 6. He says, I've applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit. But verse 6, that you may not be puffed up in favor one against another. And we're going to talk about puffed up in a second. But just think about that phrase, one against another. Somebody's better than somebody else. Notice verse 7. For who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you did not receive? Meaning with the gospel. Meaning with your finances. Meaning with all of these things. What do you have that you didn't receive? And the answer would be nothing. Verse 7 continues. If you then received it, why do you boast as though you did not receive it? Why are you walking around acting like you found it all out on your own? Why are you walking around saying that you discovered the gospel on your own? I came, I preached, Apollos watered, and God gave the growth, is what he's just said. But you're walking around like you did it all. And so verse 8. Already you have all that you want. Already you've become rich. You're already where you want. And without us, you've become kings. You are at the top of the world without us apostles. And man, we would that you did reign. Paul saying, I wish that was the case. I wish you actually were kings in the spiritual sense. But you're not. We would that you would reign so that we might share the rule with you. They're saying, I don't need you. I don't need anyone. Love does not boast. It does not parade itself. Love is not puffed up. And this may be the key word in Corinthians. For it is, I believe, used 7 times in the New Testament. 6 of them are right here in Corinthians. It's the idea of you fill yourself full of air. You fill something full of air. You puff it up to make yourself look bigger than what you are. And they were a very puffed up people about things they should not have been puffed up about. Notice the thing back in chapter 4, you're still right there, and we just said it in verse 6, that you be puffed up one against another. It's like you get in a fight, look how big I am, right? And you're doing that one against another. I wrote these things so you would not be puffed up one against another. But their tendency was, let me show you. Think about in chapter 5 with the immorality that is in the church. And he says in verse 1, he says, man, what is going on is not even among the pagans, it's not even among the Gentiles. They wouldn't even do what you're doing. But verse 2, and you are arrogant, your translation says, it is, you are puffed up. You are puffed up. Ought you not rather to mourn? Let him who's done this be removed among you. Were they supposed to be all puffed up about this immorality in the church? No, they were supposed to be mourning about it. But yet, it was something that made them feel good. It puffed them up. I forgot a couple others in chapter 4, didn't I? Go back to verse 18 of chapter 4. He says to him, some are, and your translation is going to say arrogant, or maybe say boastful. Some are, and I'm going to say it, puffed up. It's the same word. Some are puffed up as though I were not coming to you. They're saying, I'm not coming to you. But verse 19, I will come to you soon, if the Lord wills, and I'll find out the talk of these puffed up people, but their power. Meaning, I won't find out what it is that they're saying. I'll find out who they really are. And they're going to be nothing. He's an apostle of Jesus. So do you want me to come with a rod or with gentleness? He would say. People were very arrogant. We already alluded to chapter 8 as he introduces. And notice how these are at the introduction. In chapter 5 and in chapter 8, knowledge puffs up. I know something, and so it makes me feel better about it. And so what I do is I use that over somebody else. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies or builds up. Not puffs up. It builds up. Love is not that way. Love is not rude. Yours may say unseemly or unfitting or something along those lines. That's the idea. It does what is proper to do. And you might say, well, where were the Corinthians being rude and improper? Go to chapter 7 in the discussion about marriage. And I think what you have in verse 36 is you have this idea, I think, of not of a fiancé deciding not to marry his fiancé. I think it's what you have of, remember they had arranged marriages back in those days. And the father was responsible for arranging the marriage. And he would set up the marriage for his daughter for the dowry or what have you. And they would agree to this. And remember, Paul is saying at this time, it's better that you not marry due to the present distress. But notice what he encourages. Again, I believe it's the fathers, what they should not do in verse 36. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly, there's your word. If he, and let's put it in there. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly or rude toward his betrothed, if his passions are strong, and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. It is no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having the desire under the control, has determined this in his heart, will keep her as his betrothed, and he will do well. The idea is of you didn't act the way you were supposed to, what was fitting, what was proper. We'd say that was rude. He mishandled that. He says, I don't want you to do that. Don't be rude in dealing with your betrothed. But be determined, be fixed in your heart. Love does not, and we're almost done, we're getting there. And this is another one of the big ones. Insist on its own way, or your translation may say, self-seeking. It doesn't do that. In chapter 10, at the end of this discussion about meat sacrifice to idols, and you remember what he said that could do for your brother? Cause him to stumble and be destroyed back in chapter 8, right? He could be emboldened and encouraged to build on your belief system, if you will. Don't insist on your own way. Notice how he concludes it in chapter 10. As he says in verse 23, and I think from the Corinthian perspective, they would be saying to Paul, all things are lawful. And Paul would respond back, but not all things are helpful. And they would say, yeah, but all things are lawful. And Paul would say, but not all things build up. Let no one see his own good, but the good of his neighbor. You see what the Corinthians, I think, were trying to do? But everything's okay. I have knowledge. I understand. Everything is okay for me. Everything is okay. And he's saying, but not everything builds up your brother. Let no one seek his own, but that of his neighbor. Say, well, that's one time he says it. Go to the end of chapter 10. So verse 31. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all for your glory. No. Do all for the glory of God. That's utmost and most important. Whatever you do, do it for God's glory. Secondly, verse 32. Give no offense to the Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God. Don't you cause a Jew who is not a Christian to stumble. Don't you cause a Greek who is not a Christian to stumble. And don't you cause a Christian to stumble. So verse 33. Just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of the many, that they may be saved. I don't do this for myself. I do it for the many, so that they will be saved. Love does not cause anyone to stumble. Love does not insist on its own way. And Paul says there in 11:1 to conclude that thought, imitate me, as in the idea of not seeking myself and my own advantage, as I imitate Christ.
Christ didn't seek his own, did he? He didn't insist on his own way. But he submitted himself to others and to the will of the Father. Love does not do that. Then finally, as we conclude, love is not irritable. I'm a pretty grumpy guy. Some of you know that sometimes. I can be a grouch. That's not the word here. The word is being provoked. And sometimes, you remember in Acts chapter 17, when Paul's on Mars Hill and he sees all these guys, it says that he was provoked or he was stirred. The idea is he's stirred. You're stirred up by something. Sometimes we use the phrase, we get worked up. And so some of your translations say is not easily provoked, is not easily worked up. And I think that may be a better translation of that. Is not easily stirred. You don't get worked over the small things. Kind of goes on with the whole patience thing. So what were they getting worked up about? Well, how about, for one, they were fighting with one another. They were, go back to chapter 1 and see this in verse 11. Right after he said, there are divisions among you. Verse 11, for it's been reported to me by Chloe's people that there is quarreling among you. So are they at peace with one another? No, they're stirred up against one another. There's quarreling with one another. And in chapter 3 and verse 3, depending on the translation that you have from the manuscripts, the ESV that I'm holding in my hand does not include this, but the King James and the New King James does, and I think it's there. So verse 3, for you are still of the flesh while there is jealousy, there's our word envy, and I think it's contention or quarrelings in some of your translations would be the second term. New American Standard would not have it, but the King James and the New King James would have that. That would be our idea of being irritable with one another, the quarreling that is going on, the contentions. And then this third group here of the strife. They're worked up against one another. They are not at peace, but they're at war. They are at odds with one another. And love is not irritable or easily provoked. And love is not resentful. When you think about resentful, you think about you hold a grudge. And you want to get revenge. The idea right here is love does not reckon, doesn't take account of wrong that is done. And that is hard to do, isn't it? Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. It's kind of the same idea, the reckoning type of term. What were they doing in chapter 6 when their brother wronged them, he cheated them and he defrauded them? They went to law against each other. They held it against them. They said, I'm going to get it. But what did he tell them in verse 7? Ought not you better to suffer wrong and be defrauded? Shouldn't you just take the loss? But instead, I think what they're doing is they're holding it against them, and they're not handling it in the right way in-house before other Christians. But they are taking it to unbelievers. And he says, you deal with it in-house. Work it out. Don't be resentful. I said finally a second ago, this is finally. Because he concludes with, I think, one picture in mind back to chapter 5. Love is not, and love, I forgot to take the is not off of this. Love does not rejoice in wrongdoing. In chapter 5, what were they glorying in? What were they boasting about? The immorality that was in the church. About that man who had his father's wife. And notice the language that he says there in verse 2. Go back and read it. He says, you are puffed up. Ought not you rather mourn? What is the opposite of joy? Mourning, gloom, sadness. How are they supposed to feel about this great iniquity? Not rejoice in it, but mourn about it. And then he says, but love rejoices in the truth.
Remember the suggestion and the command that he gives them there in chapter 5 of what they need to do? Verse 6, your boasting, your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Cleanse it out. So verse 8, therefore let us celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil. That would be wrongdoing, unrighteousness, right? Malice and evil. Not with that, but with what? The unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. That's not the way they were living their life. They weren't living in love for that brother by not dealing with him. They weren't living that way. They were living in this boasting and in this arrogance and all of this. Now, what does it have to do with us? I talked a little longer tonight than normal, but I want you to think about this. Imagine if we actually lived this way that love is described. That I was actually patient with my brothers and sisters in Christ. I was actually kind to my brothers and sisters in Christ. I didn't care about myself. I didn't insist that it has to be done my way. I always behave properly to them. How much easier and how much better would our life be? Would we have more problems in the church or would we have less problems in the church? Love fulfills the law. We'd have a lot less problems. But what we struggle with is actually practicing love. Because it's hard. Because the world does not love. How do we know love? Because He first loved us and He gave Himself for us. If I'm not giving myself up in some way, shape, form, or fashion for my brothers and my sisters, I don't love them no matter if I say the words or not. If I'm looking out for myself rather than for my brother or my sister, I don't love them. I love myself. And the Corinthians needed love. They needed no divisions. They needed to love one another. They didn't need the immorality. They needed to love one another. They didn't need to put away their spouses. They needed to love their spouses. They didn't need to get as close to idolatry as possible. They needed to love God. They didn't, in chapter 11, need to love themselves and be hungry and fill themselves, but they needed to love their brother and wait on him and be patient with him and love what Christ did for them. Chapter 12, they didn't need more tongues. They didn't need more prophecy. They needed more love for one another. I think it's a timeless message. That if we are going to be a body of people and we are going to be the person that God expects me to be, I better be doing these things. And I ought not just be thinking about them at weddings or thinking about them when I'm teaching the book of 1 Corinthians. I need to be thinking about it day in, day out, as we talk Wednesday night, lest exhort one another daily, lest we also fall for the same heart of disbelief, hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. We need to encourage one another in the Lord. You're subject to the invitation this evening. We'd ask that you come now as we stand and as we sing.